Greetings, and welcome to Catastrophe Cast. My name is Walter, and I'm going to set the stage for the catastrophe that we're talking about today. It was very soon after 9/11 happened here in the United States, so travel was, you know, at a heightened sense of security. I woke up in a hotel room in Portland. We had just come to Portland a few days previous because we had to check on a house that was being built that we were going to buy. We were moving from Silicon Valley to the Silicon Forest, so we were moving from Sunnyvale, California up to Portland, Oregon. That morning, as we were getting ready, I turned on the television, and the first bit of information coming out on the news was there was a plane crash in New York, and there was a report that there were no survivors. Of course, the thoughts of a terrorist attack were on my mind, especially since I had a flight out that afternoon. The TV talking heads, that's all they could talk about was the 9/11 attacks and were we under attack again. So the incident that I'm actually talking about is the crash of American Airlines Flight 587 on November 12th, 2001. Flight 587 was a regularly scheduled flight that departed JFK Airport and was bound for the Dominican Republic. It was operated by American Airlines on an Airbus A300. And the Airbus A300, if you're not familiar with them, they were for short to medium distance hops, but they actually allowed you to take a large capacity of people. So you could think of it a bit like the Boeing 757. It was a routine flight, and it was going to leave JFK at about 9 a.m. and 3 hours later land in the Dominican Republic. So they pulled back away from the gate at 9 a.m. And, of course, you pull back from the gate, you head out on the taxiway, and get to the runway. Well, this plane pulled back from the gate and went through the maze of taxiways at JFK behind a line of other airplanes. Just before Flight 587 took off, there was the plane in front of it was a Japan Airlines 747 bound for Tokyo. Now, the Japan Airlines flight was cleared for takeoff at 9:11 a.m. And so it took off and 587 was on the runway behind them, ready to take off. They got clearance about 2 minutes later and took off. And at that time, the co-pilot was actually flying the plane. Now, it's really normal for pilots and co-pilots, or I'm going to use the term co-pilot and first officer here very interchangeably, but it's very normal for pilots and co-pilots to switch off duties. Well, one will take the takeoff and one will take the landing. The co-pilot was flying, like I said, and they climbed away from the airport and started crossing Jamaica Bay, which was, of course, just adjacent JFK Airport. There was a transmission between Flight 587 and the tower. Things seemed to be fine. They were at 1,300 feet, and they were climbing to 5,000 feet. And a controller cleared them to continue to climb up to 13,000 feet. But right after this transmission is when things went really, really wrong. Now, based on the accident accounts, what happened was that as soon as the transmission completed, they hit wake turbulence. Now, wake turbulence is, of course, when a plane is flying through another plane's path. So you're going to be in disturbed air. Think of it, if you're not familiar with it, think of it like a boat crossing the water and another boat crossing over the path of that boat soon after the first boat has gone. There's a lot of waves, and that makes it rougher for you to get through the area. So you can think of it like that. American Airlines pilots were all trained to deal with wake turbulence by using the rudder. They had actually a great deal of training, which we'll get into a little bit later. The co-pilot was using the rudder and called for maximum power. The pilot did indeed increase power and asked if the co-pilot was okay. The co-pilot said, yeah, and then asked again for maximum power, all the while, pushing at the rudder pedals. Just after this point, of course, he had gotten max power, was still pushing on the rudders. There was a loud thumping sound that was heard on the cockpit voice recorder. Seconds after the transmission ended, and as this was going on in the air, captured only by the cockpit voice recorder, as the co-pilot struggled to get them out of this wake turbulence, people on the ground said that they first heard and then saw the plane start to break up in midair. Pieces of the plane sheared off, the two engines sheared off, and landed about 100 feet from each other. The plane spun around like a top as it fell out of the sky, and it crashed in the Rockaway Island neighborhood, crushing several houses and setting several more ablaze. Of course, this was 2001, so everybody was talking about terrorism. Like I said, that was the only thing that was on the television that morning. And that truly ruled the response. Flights were canceled out of New York and New Jersey. Traffic going in and out of the city was restricted. Speculation just started and just continued to snowball as previously strained sources. We lost a lot of firefighters and police on 9/11, so those resources were already strained, but now they were having to react to a brand new catastrophe. Buildings like the Empire State Building and the United Nations, those were evacuated and put on lockdown. Investigations around the world focused on terrorism, as the NTSB worked. So you've got the NTSB who's looking at what the situation was and what could have caused it. But of course, people around the world are going to try to help out because at that point, we thought, terrorism. Let's find out what we can. There was a captured Al-Qaeda operative said in about mid-2004, before the actual NTSB report came out, that there was a Canadian citizen on that plane, and the Canadian citizen named Abdur-Rauf Jaddeh, he was the one that brought the flight down in the name of Al-Qaeda. It was supposedly the bomb that Jaddeh was using was supposed to be a shoe bomb, like the one that Richard Reid, the shoe bomber who was captured in December 2001, it was very much like he the one that he was tried to use. So all this speculation happened for years afterward, until December 2004, the real cause of the accident was released by the NTSB. And of course, the accident was part mechanical and part human error, but that human error, of course, caused the mechanical. So what really happened? The big issue was that due to overstress by the controls, the vertical stabilizer. Now, the vertical stabilizer is the tail fin. So when you look at an airplane, the part that is the tallest, the fin at the very back, that on 587 detached from the plane. Without the vertical stabilizer, you cannot control the plane. That's why it just spun as like a top in the air. That loss ultimately sealed the fate of 587 and all the passengers. The spin that started after the vertical stabilizer was ripped from the plane caused a great deal of structural forces to be put on the plane, and it literally ripped the plane apart in midair. The human factor part of this had a few different facets. We know that the first officer was flying the plane because of the cockpit voice recorder. It was recovered and we could hear his voice. We know that the first officer pressed the rudder. Now, the rudder, of course, is controlled by a pedal on the floor multiple times, both left and right. He used the rudder back and forth and back and forth in an attempt to get out of the wake turbulence. And we know that the excessive force put on the rudder because of what the co-pilot was using, that was what tore the airplane apart. Digging into this, I learned a bit about the whole rudder and tailpiece on the A300 and the A310, which shared the same feature. They knew at a minimum you had to use about 22 pounds of force to move the rudder at all. So push down, you can't just push down lightly. You had to use 22 pounds of force with your foot to move the rudder in any amount. And the amount of space that the rudder could move actually was dictated by the speed of the airplane. At 165 knots, to implement a full 30-degree rudder deflection, you had to use about 65 pounds of force. But at 250 knots, so, nearly twice the initial speed, you only had to use 32 pounds of force to get a 10-degree rudder deflection. So that in itself is I have to use a lot of force when I'm below at 165 knots or below, or I have to use just a little bit of force when I'm at 250 knots. So that is part of the design, and that is it kind of led to the whole destruction of the airplane. Now, American Airlines trained their pilots to use the rudder to overcome wake turbulence. It was a standard procedure. They had implemented training back in the 90s to deal with what was called selective event training. These were events that happened that they thought they could train people out of. The training incidents themselves came from real life incidents and occurred on many flights between the 80s and the 90s. So those were the events that were used to train these pilots so that they could learn to get out of the situation. Another little factor is that American Airlines did know, and this is per a memorandum from the NTSB back in May of 1997, that excessive force on a rudder control could cause issues with the airplane. So you've got training that was being done, and you've got, this is how you deal with situation X, and this is how you deal with situation Y. Part of that training had to deal with using the rudder to get out of certain situations. Well, American Airlines, they got the in memorandum from the NTSB, and they responded to the NTSB that no, we're not a rudder first or rudder only company. We teach our pilots and co-pilots to deal with the situation as they need to. So they may use the rudder, they may not. They know the appropriate training to get out of wake turbulence and other issues that they're going to encounter. So there were some training issues that these pilots had gone through. The co-pilot himself was actually under fire for excessive use of force, and in this case, it was the excessive use of force when pushing at the rudder. Many of the co-pilot's co-workers testified that, at least anecdotally, he was prone for excessive use of force on the rudders in dealing with turbulence. One pilot said that he and his co-pilot, now this is another one, were in a similar situation to American Airlines 587, and that first officer who was flying the plane at the time reacted the same way that the co-pilot on 587 did. He used excessive force on the rudders, alternating back and forth, the left rudder, left pedal, right pedal, left pedal, right pedal, left pedal, right pedal, alternating between each one to try and get control of the plane. That, of course, was putting a lot of stress on the structure of the airplane. When the pilot asked the co-pilot why he did that, the co-pilot responded that that was the training that he had received from American Airlines on how to get out of difficult situations like the ones they had just gotten through. So, you've got a plane that was overstressed and ripped apart because of the stress of excessive rudder use. You've got a co-pilot who was known to use excessive force when it came to rudder use. And you've got other pilots that were exposed to training on how to deal with these situations, but didn't understand the entire picture when it came to how to deal with the issue. They only knew part of the problem, and a single solution didn't always work. One solution isn't an end-all, be-all solution for everything, but they were trained to think that it was. Finally, the last little piece of the investigation concluded that the magnitude of movement that the rudder on the A300 actually could perform was mostly outside of a pilot's experience. Sure, you know, they could perform the maneuver, but it often could produce results that far exceeded their expectations. Like I said, at 165 knots, a 30-degree rudder deflection, that would be a dang fast turn. So that itself, it comes down to training and design of the rudder. So when you put it all together, you have a co-pilot that was pressing the rudder pedals multiple times, putting stress on the airplane, and trying to get out of the turbulence like he was trained to do. But instead of correcting the situation, he overcorrected, and those actions basically task the airplane structure far too much, causing it to come apart in mid-flight. In all, there were 265 people that died that day, just 2 months and 1 day post 9/11. There were 260 passengers and crew aboard American Airlines Flight 587, and there were additional 5 people that were on the ground in their homes or on the street that were killed. During the investigation, the NTSB investigators found there were 6 other incidents because of rudder problems, 3 on the A300 and 3 on the A310. So this was, even though the most catastrophic incident, it was not isolated. It's just that the other 6 incidents did not involve the detachment of the rudder and therefore loss of the airframe. There's one little haunting line that was in the NTSB report, and it said, if the first officer had ceased his inputs any time prior to the failure of the vertical stabilizer, the accident would have been averted. Just think about that one line. One little change would have saved 265 souls. It took just over 11 years, but the FAA mandated that Airbus make a change to the A300 and the A310 structure of the tail assembly. The A300 and A310 shared the same rudder controls, and the FAA demanded these changes to make them safer. There were 2 options that were put forth. The first was a flashing light that could be installed in the cockpit, along with a sounded alarm, and that would warn against excessive use of the force on the rudder. This would cost about $107,000 per airplane. The second option was almost twice that at $198,500 per airplane. That solution would have actually installed new hardware on each and every airplane and would actually limit the movement of the rudder. The operators said that in the 4 years they were tasked to be able to do this, so I'm giving this to you today in 2017, you have to have it done by the same day in 2021. They said that, well, there wasn't just enough time to be able to do the second option, of course, the more expensive option. However, the first option they could do. So within 4 years, all remaining A300 and A310 had an alarm installed in the cockpit that warns of excessive use of the rudders that could lead to a structural failure of the airplane. To this day, there are more than 300 Airbus A300 and A310s in operation, including the iconic Airbus Beluga. If you've ever seen it, that is a version of the A300 that looks like it's pregnant because it is used to transport enormous parts of other airplanes. Most of the A300 and A310s in use are in Asia and Africa. However, there are about 130 of them that are operated by FedEx and UPS. So there are more than a handful that are flying over your head on a daily basis here in the United States. Or if you're flying in Asia, if you're flying in Africa, if you're flying in parts of Europe, you more than likely have to deal with an A300 every single day. So that's it, the podcast of the crash of American Airlines Flight 587 on my birthday, 2001. I want to thank everyone for their suggestions. Please keep them coming. The next podcast is going to be a listener suggestion about my favorite vacation spot in the world. That's just a little teaser. As usual, you can contact me. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/catastrophecast. Hit us up on Twitter at catastrophecast. You can email me. The email is podcast@catastrophecast.com, or just head over to our website. There's lots of features on the website, including get a hold of me feature and a feature telling me what you want to listen to next. That's it, of course, catastrophecast.com. Thanks for listening.